Words to Mouth, Show Number 15, June 20th, 2008. Today, Robert Hicks, editor and story contributor to A Guitar and a Pen. Welcome to Words to Mouth, an author interview talk show where readers meet authors beyond the printed page and win free books. I'm your host, Carrie, and today I'm speaking with Robert Hicks. Well, I have to admit, I actually recorded this intro after our conversation. I had such a great time chatting with Robert. He's an easygoing, likable guy. He makes it very easy to see yourself hanging out at his place in Nashville. I think I may have overstepped my boundaries a bit by inviting myself to his next guitar pull, but he was ever gracious. Listen in and enjoy as we talk about country music songwriters, America's ultimate short storytellers. Robert, I really enjoyed reading A Guitar and a Pen. You put this book together with John Bollinger and Justin Stelter.
With John Bollinger, yes, and Justin
Bollinger, Stelter. Thank you.
It was actually okay. John's idea. He took Justin and me to lunch, gosh, 5 or 6 years, almost 6 years ago, and basically said, you know, what would I think about this? Were we interested in it? And it was just such a fantastic idea. From that day forward, I said I wanted to be part of it. Unfortunately, I had another book that I was working on, and I had to kind of focus on at the time, so we had to set it aside a bit. But that said, it was never far from my heart as a project.
How did you all get together in the first place?
Well, I've been a music publisher for, gosh, 20-something years in Nashville. And John is a singer-songwriter who had actually come to me, and we had talked about working together. There just wasn't a niche for him in my company at the time, but he's hugely talented. And so I was very, very concerned never to lose contact with him, because he's just really an incredibly talented singer-songwriter in Nashville. Now he's the band leader of Nashville Star, the hit TV show.
What are some of his songs?
Oh, he's had a, you know what? I wouldn't even be able to tell you. That's terrible.
Okay.
But he's had a bunch of songs over the years.
Okay.
And but you know, he's super, as I say, super talented. So he had approached me. He felt like this was a project that he couldn't do by himself. And so I was like, yeah, I'd love to be part of it, to tell you the truth.
And how did you go about gathering all these stories? Did you handpick the individuals,
right,
or did you kind of get the word out there and people came to you with the stories?
Exactly.
Or?
The first thing I did, literally, I guess a day or two afterwards, was I sent out an email to friends and just said, you know, that the Nashville songwriter is the ultimate short story writer. You know, have you ever considered writing a short story? And I sent the email to people like Chris Christopherson and Tom T. Hall and Charlie Daniels. Well, all three of them had written short stories in their past. But then I sent it to a lot of people like Cal Ketchum and folks that T.S. Sellers and folks that really never had before. And so we just simply try to let people know about the project idea, and almost immediately short stories started coming in. In fact, I'll say this, we almost had a book full of short stories within, I guess, 6 months to a year. But then again, I was working on this other book, and I just had to put it aside so that I could be involved with that and focused on that.
And that book was Widow of the South.
Widow of the South, right.
It just happened to make the New York Times bestseller list, right?
So I guess I did. Maybe I made the right decision. I'm not sure.
Yeah, maybe that was a good plan.
Yeah.
So did you end up with more stories than you could fit in the book?
We did. In fact, you know, we are interested in possibly doing another book. It isn't that we don't have some great stories left. It's just that the publisher finally said, yeah, I think at 25 stories you have enough.
Right.
You know, that you don't want to. There's kind of a size that is good for books. You know, and I don't tell Stephen King or Tom Wolfe that, but unless you're Stephen King or you're Tom Wolfe, very few people are going to pick up a book that's like, you know, 600 pages big. And there is a size where it just simply doesn't work if the book is too big.
Right. Well, in the foreword, Vince Gill says, "A Guitar and a Pen is a long overdue celebration of the talent of not just these writers, but all of country music storytellers." Can you expound on that a little bit?
Well, you know what? I have always taken my cue from John's original comments to me at the table that day that Vince almost paraphrased exactly that they really are the ultimate short story writers, that songwriters, that the national or the country songwriter is the guy that's out there creating these tiny little stories. I mean, you know, you take Marty Robbins' El Paso, and literally in less than 3 minutes he tells us this almost epic tale of this cowboy, of his love, his lost love. He ends up, you know, there's violent crime, there's death, there's love lost, love found, all in under 3 minutes. So, you know, to me, that is not the exception. That's the rule for the country songwriter. And I think what Vince is probably saying there is that this isn't just about these guys and gals. It's about so many songwriters, national songwriters, country songwriters who are writing these epic tales, you know. And what we wanted to say is that, you know, for so long, there's almost been like there's high literary art, what I suppose we do, and then there's songwriting. And what we're really saying in this book is, no, there isn't two. There's one. That what they're doing is simply short story writing. And so I hope what this does is I hope that this kind of raises the bar as far as people understanding what the country songwriter does. And at the same time, it also is to be an encouragement, not just to these people where we took their stories, but to basically every country songwriter out there. You know, as I said to a friend of mine one day, Steve Earle isn't the exception. Now, he might slug me for saying that, but the truth is he's not. Tom T. Hall is not the exception. He may be exception in just the quality of his writing, his exquisite writing. And one of my, I think one of the really the most beautifully written stories in this book is Tom T. Hall's. But the truth is that they're not the exceptions. They're the rule. All these songwriters, whether they're in this collection or not, all these men and women who come to Nashville, who put pen to paper, are really writing little short stories.
Now, do you think that it transfers across all songwriting or just more specific to country music?
Well, I'm going to say that as much as I would like to, as a kind of an advocate of the country songwriter, say that it's only country songwriting, I think it goes across all the lines to some extent. But I don't think anywhere does it do it more than it does in country music. I mean, but they're in almost every genre of music, from hip-hop, you know, to any kind of storytelling genre, there is that short story element to it.
Now, you yourself said in the book that you didn't initially like country music.
What?
Tell us when that changed for you.
Well, I moved to Nashville to go to college, and I ended up in a bar one night, I guess at some point, as every college student pretty much does, and I met a girl who wanted to be a country music star. I not only had never met anyone that wanted to be a country music star, I've never met anyone who even liked country music that I could remember. and she did. She was passionate about it. And she ended up taking me to the alley of the Ryman Auditorium, which was then the Opry. And we stood in the alley. In those days, there wasn't a backstage, since there has been, but in those days there wasn't. And so the performers, before they went on stage, since it was really a church building, would either stand out in the alley and smoke cigarettes, or they would go across the alley to one of the bars, a bar called Tootsie's Orchid Lounge. And but a lot of them just stood outside if the night was nice. And there was a couple out there, and they were arguing, and she was kind of, to me, with my sensibility, very overdressed. And she and her, as I listened to the argument, husband, were arguing over fidelity issues. And it got really heated. And all of a sudden, they started whopping on each other.
Oh, jeez.
I had never seen... I not only had never seen a man hit a woman, I'd never seen a woman hit a man. And they're whopping on each other, and all of a sudden, this kid runs out of down the steps of the Ryman, the Opry, and he tells her that she's on in 5 minutes. And she stops, and this really raging, violent situation turns almost immediately to her having him help her with her makeup.
Gosh.
And 5 minutes later, maybe really, really closer to 10 minutes later, she's on the stage singing "I Never Promised You a Rose Garden."
Oh my gosh!
And I'm sitting there going, "Who are these people?" You know, I mean, it was just so foreign. And somehow, and I hate to tell you that domestic violence led me to country music, but domestic violence led me to country music. Was just so. I was so taken by these people and how they wore their feelings, kind of like they wore their rhinestones. Everything was out front. And I just thought, I've got to know more about what these people are about, who they are. And so I went back week after week and stood in that alley, got to know some of them, started listening to country music. It didn't hurt that the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band had put out Will a Circle Be Unbroken, this wonderful, wonderful collection of songs.
Uh-huh.
And they made it a little cooler to be able to like country music. And,
right.
And it just went from there. It's been a real deep love affair ever since.
Well, there's something, I mean, it's funny because I have a similar situation like you. I didn't like country music particularly, and I remember being a marketing rep and going into a little convenience store and hearing Randy Travis. It's funny, I have that moment kind of etched in my mind for some reason. Randy Travis singing Forever and Ever, Amen.
Right.
I think that's the title of the song. And went, you know, got back in my car and got on that radio station and got hooked. And I think it's just because you can just so relate to those songs. I mean, you talk about domestic violence, but, you know, in the book and in the songs, there's stories about love, there's stories about poverty, and, you know,
exactly.
You had a major story about racism and a lot of funny stories, too. The one about the email hoax was particularly funny.
That's a great story. That's by Bobby Braddock. And Bobby really wrote, I think we can say, the greatest country song of all time, He Stopped Loving Her Today. And he has that wonderful ability to write. And he's our poster child in so many ways. I saw him at the dinner for the Country Music Hall of Fame one night. No, Songwriters Hall of Fame dinner. And I told him about this, and he was slightly distracted. We're old friends. And he was slightly distracted, and he didn't exactly hear what I was saying. And so he said, yeah, he would love to do it. So I sent him an email the next day, the email I was sending out to everyone to pitch the project. And as soon as he read it, he realized it was completely different than what he had thought. What he thought I was asking for was a kind of a little vignette story of how you wrote a particular song. And what I really was asking was you to write a short story, long or short, to really create a story. And he just wrote me back, and he said, I'm a songwriter, I can't do that. And so I wrote him back, and I said, I understand, but I wish you'd reconsider. And then he wrote me back, and he said, I wish you'd stop hounding me. I can't do this. I've already told you. It's not what I do. And it went back and forth. And about 2 weeks later, he showed up with that story, this wonderful little story, very, very funny tale. And so I think that's exactly, what we hoped for. We hoped that men and women who had never envisioned, like T.S. Sellers, that they were going to be short story writers are short story writers. It's not that they're going to become it. They are. They've proven it with their stories. And Tia has told me that she's continuing to write, as Don Cook told me, since he wrote the story for this collection. He's written three more. And so this is exactly what I was hoping for. My goal is, as a friend of mine says, Robert, you've never had a hidden agenda in your life. It's always been out in the open, and you never had a small one. My goal is that in the next 10 to 15 years, you're going to see a whole mess of legitimate writers coming out of Nashville. And they're going to come out because that these men and women dared to step forward and try to write.
It's neat that you're that catalyst, because it's true. I guess people don't even think of themselves as short story writers, you know? So
exactly.
it's neat that you've been able to pull that out.
That's the whole point. I mean, and if you've been told that you can't really be considered a legitimate short story writer, and if country songwriters think, oh, that's something that Steve Earle does, or that's something that Tom T. Hall does, or that's something that Charlie Daniels does, but that's not something I could do. Now, here you have the songwriter that's written the greatest country song of all time, who couldn't see himself as a short story writer, and he is. And he's not just a short story writer, he's a really good short story writer.
Was there a lot of editing involved, or these stories, were they pretty good at just putting it up?
A lot less editing than you would think. There was some editing involved, but, you know, as someone who's in the middle of editing purgatory right now myself with my second novel, I know what editing is. And it can be a nasty, long, drawn-out thing, although I've just started it on this novel. But there was some involved, but there was no need to, you know, just rewrite it or anything. The stories were solid.
One of the things that I saw in your book, you talked about guitar pools. Can you tell us a little bit about these guitar pools?
It's truly a Nashville tradition, although I think that the oldest guitar pool in Nashville these days isn't in Nashville. It's out at my farm. but it really goes back to the early 20th century when songwriters, men and women, would get together. And back then, they were lucky if even one of them had a guitar. And so they would sit in kind of a circle around a room, and they would pull the guitar, i.e. pass the guitar around the room. And now, I had one about 2 weeks ago, and if there are 30 songwriters that show up, I guarantee you there'll be 30 guitars. But we still call them guitar pulls. And I would hear old-timers, again, 20 years ago, talking about guitar pulls in Nashville. And for a long time, I thought they were saying guitar pools. And I thought maybe they call it that because they pooled their guitars together. Finally, I asked an old-timer, what is a guitar pool? And he said, no, it's a guitar pull. And I was like, okay. Once again, what's a guitar pull? And he explained it to me. And so I thought, you know what a fantastic evening that might be. And so the first guitar pull I had was about 20 years ago now. And John Kay, who is Steppenwolf, was there. And John Hyatt and two or three other singer-songwriters were there. And everybody enjoyed it, because there was no pretense. And we've had some incredible pulls out here from the late Harlan Howard to Keith Richards.
Wow.
From Mary Chapin Carpenter to people like John Hyatt. And I don't have as many as I used to have. I used to have about every, 6 weeks to 2 months. And it's just, once I became really serious about writing, it became harder and harder to have pulls out here. But it's something once I'm having one, I go, gosh, I should do this all the time.
I want to come.
I'd love you to come. I mean, basically, I do have to tell you this. You always have to bring a covered dish, preferably not a dessert. Now,
hey, I can cook. I can cook. I can't play guitar or sing, but I can listen
bring
food.
You bring a covered dish. We have,
okay.
We do just like the old days. We have a prayer and a dinner, and then we sit down and along with, we're classic Southerners, along with praying, there's a lot of drinking, and then we get together and we start having a pull, and so the first time, Mary Chapin's been three or four times, so the first time that Chapin was coming, and I was describing it she said, let me get this straight. We not only entertain you, but we bring you dinner. And I kind of laughed and said, something like that. And she said, Robert, I don't know if anyone has told you this, but we actually do this for a living.
We get paid.
We get paid to entertain people. We don't That's usually great. Have to feed them, too. And
funny.
But anyway, she's brought some great dishes along the way. So yeah, so you bring a covered dish, and there was the only really nasty moment was about, gosh, 6 or 7 years ago, why I ruled out dessert. And everyone hates that I rule out desserts, but I have a reason, is that that night there were about 37 dishes, and every single one of them was dessert.
Oh, man.
Everyone brought dessert. It was like a diabetes convention or something. So I said, no more desserts. I ended up having to go into my cabinets and literally fix dinner for about 60 people.
Oh, my gosh.
I always say no desserts. Fortunately, a friend of mine, Kurt Jones, invented Dippin' Dots ice cream.
Oh, okay.
He ends up usually bringing Dippin' Dots for everyone. So first time he came, he didn't understand the no dessert policy. He thought it was a personal attack on him and his ice cream, but it is. And it was just trying to be sure I didn't end up having to fix everyone dinner again.
Well, you can tell him his product is one of my kids' favorites. So
oh gosh. It's everything.
Have you given any thought to ever recording those, like the guitar pool unplugged or anything like that?
Public television has talked to us pretty seriously about doing it a couple of times, and we've just had to try to figure out if it would be possible without it becoming too disruptive. I mean, one of the things that I've always said on the invitation, I pretty much sent it out by email, is no business cards, no career development, you know, because I don't want people coming there. You do at times feel like, if you're not careful, that it's an industry event, and you want to be sure that people don't feel that way. And so consequently, I don't know how we could do it and it not become something different than the way it is now.
Yeah, it's almost like you'd have to get somebody that you know to record it and then offer it up rather than have them come and, you know, run the show, because it's like, you know, you were saying with Mary, it's the business side of it, and it sounds like for you all to get together and just enjoy your craft is relaxing and a good time, and you don't want to ruin that. So
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's what you just want to be sure that mm-hmm. that's there.
So have you given any thought to doing a companion music CD with the book, or
we talked about it. The problem with those things, and we were very interested in it, and the publisher was interested, the more that we both looked at it, and they looked at it pretty seriously, is it's a lot of work, a lot of money, because, you know, it's them going out and getting permission to use, let's say, songs by these artists. And many times, as much as this sounds kind of odd, the artists don't own the publishing on their song. And so it's not just asking Bobby Braddock or Chris Christopherson, can we use this song? It's trying to be sure that we use a song that Bobby Braddock and Chris Christopherson have publishing to. And then you have to go to the, if you don't use their version, which of course in the case of someone like Charlie Daniels or Chris Christopherson, or even Bobby Braddock, it would be an excellent version. But some of them aren't singers. So then we got into the point of getting permission to use a particular version of a song. And it went on and on and on. And finally, my publisher just said, Stop.
The headache, yeah.
This is not going to work.
Mm. Well, can you tell us a little bit about Uncle Willis? I thought that story was hysterical.
You know, let me just tell you this story. Okay. Before the book came out, one of my cousins called me, a distant cousin of mine called me, and she's a wonderful person, and she said, Robert, this is your cousin, Frances. And I said, hey, Frances, how are you doing? She said, I'm not doing too well. And I said, well, what's wrong? And she said, well, there is a nasty story going around our family that you have written something about us.
Uh-oh.
And our great uncle was really named Homer. And I said, oh, about that I wrote about us eating Uncle Homer. And she said, yes. And I said, well, don't worry about this, Francis, because I changed his name to Willis, and there's no Willis in our family, so no one will ever know. And she said, I do believe that disguise is a little too thin. And I said, well, you know, I just thought it was such a great story. And she said, Robert, there is something really wrong with all this. And I said, now, let me ask a question, Francis. Is there something wrong with the fact that we ate our great uncle one Thanksgiving or that I wrote about it? And she paused on the phone. There was this long silence. And she said, Robert, we are about 8 years difference in age. And when you were younger, I should have done this, but someone should have told you a long time ago, you just need to learn to put a lid on things. And then she hung up.
That's funny.
Yes, the story about eating our great uncle Willis is actually a thin disguise so that no one will ever know about the time that my family got together one Thanksgiving and ate my great-uncle, Homer. And so I'm hoping that you'll keep that a secret and no one will ever know about that.
But. Yeah, okay. I'm sure no one will pass that along. Good. That's great.
Good. Okay. So, yes, and so it is really based on a true story. In fact, it's pretty close to right there. In fact, a few of the names I didn't even change because the names were too good.
Yeah.
My aunt.
That's crazy. That truth is stranger than fiction sometimes, huh?
Well, you know, it's as I say, you can't tell me that. You tell me a Southern family that claims they've never eaten a relative and they've never devoured one of their own, whether it be literally or you know, verbally. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you a family that's lying to you. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just seems, you know, I was in New York doing this book event, and it was kind of a real she, and it was on elements of Southern writing, and one of them was food. And we were almost at the end of the question and answer. It was with four other authors. And one of the people in the audience got up and said, have any of y'all ever written on a favorite meal? And I just finished writing the short story, and I was just so tempted. And finally I said, well, actually, I have recently written about the fact that when I was 8 years old, we ate my great-uncle one Thanksgiving. The audience gets very, very quiet. And finally, the thing is over, and this woman comes up at the reception, and she says, oh, she said, is that true story? And I said, yes, it is. And she said, oh, I just think that's so wonderful. She said, it's so pagan. She said, you know, that you take a relative that you love, and you eat them, so you have their qualities and powers.
Oh, yikes.
And I looked at her, and I said, well, the truth is, actually, didn't really like him. And I'm not kidding you. This woman looked at me with horror, and she said, you ate a relative that you didn't like and love? And I went, yes. And she went, that's sick. Now let's think about this.
That's just bizarre.
There's nothing wrong with eating a relative you love. But it's sick to eat a relative you don't like.
And I went, yeah, let's differentiate there.
And so she said, you are a Southerner, and walked away.
Oh, that is hysterical.
So anyway, I guess I'm a Southerner. Now I know. It just takes, you know, eating someone you hate it. But anyway, so yeah, so that's that story. And people have asked me to tell it when I'm doing readings at bookstores, and I won't tell it because I just want to leave it up to people to buy the book and find out how exactly we did eat him.
It's great. It's awesome. Is your the current novel that you're writing, are you almost done with that? Are you still, you said you were in the editing
process? I'm done. I'm editing. I finished it. I handed it in to my publisher. My publisher bought it.
Excellent.
They had a deal, but you know, they could have rejected it. And they, my editor seemed to be over the top about it. I mean, I wasn't expecting that, to tell you the truth, and she seemed to be. And sure enough, when we finally had an editing meeting, what she's asking for is very doable. And so that's what I'm in the process of doing this summer, is just sitting down and working on some, I'm not going to say minor, but some very doable changes that, I think she's right. You know, that's great. And especially, to tell you the truth, it's great to have a woman who to read it, because for me, because there's just certain things that I don't see, know, that I have my own limitations. And so for having her just ask me questions, you know, once I got into writing, I had no idea what editing was like. And as I describe editing is like playing hot and cold with someone, but they never say hot. You know, mm-hmm. they'll just say cold, 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 cold. And then if you don't like the way I do it, tell me how to do it differently. But they don't do that. They have to kind of lead you back to the desk to try to figure out how to fix these things. But I have an excellent editor, as I did on the first novel. I was a different editor, and she truly is. She's truly a fine, fine editor. And I hope to be finished by sometime in August.
Oh, good. Do you want to tell us the name of the book and give us a little teaser?
Wow. I don't know what the name of the book is. I do. Okay. Right now, it's called The Fortunate Ones, and it's basically the last 11 years of John Bell Hood's life, who was a general here at Franklin. But it's not about the Civil War. It's about what happened to him in the years afterwards. He moved to New Orleans. He had lost his entire right leg at Chickamauga. He lost the use of his left arm. He still had it, but it was a withered left arm at the Battle of Gettysburg. And yet he married really one of the belles of New Orleans. And in 11 years of marriage, they had 11 children.
Oh, Lord.
And then he died, which the book starts out with him dying, so I'm not giving anything away, but he died of yellow fever. He and his wife both died of yellow fever within a few days of each other and left orphans. But it's really about that marriage. It's about that marriage and about who he became and who we reinvent ourselves to be and are transformed into. And in so doing, it's also about New Orleans. It really is. It's to me, it's about the city, how it became the city it is today, both in tragedy and in its triumphs. I think most of them were set in place in the 1870s. And so New Orleans really is almost a character in the book. So that's kind of a short synopsis of it.
Well, it sounds wonderful. Hopefully you can come back and talk to us about it when it gets published.
I really
would. Okay, great. Okay, is there anything else you'd like to leave us with as far as a guitar and a pen? Any big message you'd like to leave us with?
Sure. I hope that everybody will go out and buy a copy of it. And if anyone is thinking about buying anyone a gift for about $25 in the next you know, 3 or 4 months, I hope it'll be a copy of A Guitar and a Pen. I know that people will enjoy it as much as I have. You know, it's been a lot easier for me to go out and sell A Guitar and a Pen than, let's say, sell my own novels, because I can be objective and say I truly know how good the stories are and how enjoyable they are.
They really are, and they, you know, it's one of those books that you can pick up and just, you don't have to be in any order. You can just, you know, grab a story and read it and go back and read another one at a different time. So it is really wonderful.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time, and I hope people do enjoy it as much as we have.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Why don't you give us your website address, and I'll make sure I put that in the show notes.
Okay. It's www.aguitarandapen.com.
That's easy. Okay.
And so please have people go to it, because it's a good website. I'm very, very proud of it. And there's also a MySpace page that's A Guitar and a Pen, too.
Yeah, it's a very, you have, whoever put it together did a really good job, so.
Well, I'm very, very proud of that, too. And again, it's always easy for me to be proud of things that I am that I didn't do. And so those are things I'm very proud of.
Well, I haven't read your novel yet, but I think
you
I need to pick
up. You don't have to, but, you know, the main character is based on you. Her name's Carrie.
Oh, well, then I definitely need to read it.
I mean, I based her on your life, and and so I thought that was our whole connection. Well,
oh yeah, I forgot.
Exactly. We'll come to Franklin, and you can after you read if you do read The Widow of the South, you can come to Franklin, and you can actually. I can show you the story because it's really based on a true story, and it's a lot of what is in the book is still here in Franklin.
Well, I'll have to read the book, make a covered dish, and show up at one of your next guitar.
I would love you to do that.
Okay. All right,
cook,
Robert.
Okay.
What?
If you can cook, you're welcome, okay?
I can cook.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Robert. You take care.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Uh-huh. Bye. Congratulations to Ron Vinker for winning the free copy of A Guitar and a Pen. I actually pulled his name with the rest of the last round of winners, so I encourage all of you to click on the book image on wordstomouth.com and purchase this book. It's a great gift, and it's one of those books that you can pick up and put down in short stints since one chapter doesn't really relate to the other. I wanted to give you a bit of a heads up. Coming soon on Words to Mouth, media expert Jason Van Orden and Brenda Novak. I got to speak with her. She just released a book called Trust Me a few weeks ago, and I called the morning after she made the New York Times bestseller list, so that was pretty exciting. After that, we'll talk with J.C. Hutchins. He's the author of the Seventh Son trilogy, and you can prep for that conversation by visiting jchutchins.net. It's H-U-T-C-H-I-N-S. He's got an amazing website and community there, so you'll have a lot of fun. I wanted to encourage you to give me your address when you enter for the free book drawing. I've been having a couple issues with some people winning, and then I can't track down their mailing address. So when you email me, just include your mailing address, and I promise I won't give it out to anybody. I'm going to be getting a newsletter and email program together, so that shouldn't be a problem. But for now, just make sure you send me your address. What else? Hey, be the first to call 206-309-7318 and leave me a voicemail message. Come on, you guys, speak up. Here's the deal. Whoever is the first to call and leave me a voicemail message will receive a free copy of Barefoot. I think the name is Eileen. I'm not sure. E-L-I-N. Hildebrand. I'm just finishing this book up. It's a great beach read about three women and a 20-something college student. Uh-huh. Self Magazine says, think beaches meets The Graduate. Is that enticing or what? So give me a call. If you want Words to Mouth downloaded to your computer for free, you can go through iTunes to subscribe. And as always, thank you to Natalie Brown for her song, You Gotta Believe, from the PodSafe Music Network. Thanks for listening, you guys, and take good care until next time.